That's Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers with something called Dat Dare, as in take dat over dare. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It's Thursday, January the 3rd, and it's a new Congress, but will it be old politics? The 113th Congress is seated today in the immediate aftermath of contentious negotiations, as you will recall, on the so-called fiscal cliff and the prospect of continuing partisan acrimony on debt, taxes, and austerity measures that are sure to come in order to produce a national budget, a balanced budget. All along, people are worrying, will this Congress be able to shake off its do-nothing past? Will legislators actually carry out the wishes of the people? Will President Obama do the right thing by the communities and constituencies that put him in office? The real question, really, is are we prepared for battle, because that's what the next 4 years will be. There is no doubt about it. So this Congress, this new Congress, the 113th Congress, has an immediate problem. It's got some other issues to deal with, and these are post-fiscal cliff, but they might as well be pre-fiscal cliff, because they still have a bunch of arguing going on to get these matters resolved. There's a deep and bitter political divide, even within the parties themselves, both the Democratic and Republican parties, more so in the Republican parties, as we've seen, because they've been kind of out there with it. And that is one of the issues that will surface as this new Congress deals with the other issues that will confront it. A major issue will be this matter of sequestration, which is an automatic across-the-board cut that will occur in federal spending unless they're able to come to terms with how they're going to fund these programs and beat the deadline that is expected to kick in for in about 2 months. But, you know, I'm torn about this because it is so predictable what's going to happen in Congress. And to be very truthful about it, I'm less concerned about what Congress would do only because it is so predictable. I'm more concerned about what people will do. What are you and I prepared to do? How do we get out of this next 4 years? How do we get out of these next 4 years what we actually need? How do we impact policy? You know, it was really clear when the fighting was going on over the fiscal cliff issues that the people almost were, and not almost, but we were spectators to this blood sport occurring in Washington, D.C. And there was a very clear sense that even with the representatives that we have, the people who were elected to represent us, they too were, you know, shunted away. They were outside of the circles of power and influence, which is outrageous. What we need, therefore, to do is to bear in mind that we're fighting on two fronts. Well, actually three. I would say we are fighting Congress as it is. We're fighting for ourselves, and we're fighting for a process. some people would say, well, it's not worth it. It is better to organize something else and leave Washington to itself, let it do what it is accustomed to doing. But I believe that we ought to mount a very credible resistance. Why? Because an investment has been made. And it makes no sense, after this investment has been made, to simply stand idly by and let whatever happens happen. That's not good for me. That's not a good answer. That's not a good attitude. So what is it that we ought to be thinking about right now, outside of the process as we are? What should we be thinking? Should we be thinking of really organizing, I mean, seriously getting down to organizing a credible alternative? Should we leverage the power that we already have invested and do so with the idea of extracting from an unwilling political process exactly what we need or close to what we need? Or do we just wash our hands and say, well, you know, we'll just wait till the next thing comes along and we see if that is better? I think we have to start asking these questions. And I think we should take a look at how, in the political process, we need to break also from our bad habits. And the bad habits that we have include getting all excited during an election year, and then we disappear. As if on cue, we just fade away into the sunset. And then we wait for another 4 years. But if you're paying attention to what's going on, you see how serious the situation is. And you see how serious the consequences are likely to be. How lethal they can be to our interests. And I say our meaning, I'm presuming here that we share a common concern for average people. What it is that we want out of our country, out of this process we call democracy. What is it that we are supposed to be as citizens? As the electorate, what are we entitled to do? It was very troubling noticing this whole last several months with Barack Obama and Boehner, and then, you know, the cast of characters are changing, but essentially they are all of one mind. They are clear that they have the power. Yes, it was given to them, but in their heads, it's earned power. It's entitled power. They got the vote of the people because they're the better person. All right? They're the better choice. And if they were the better choice, nobody would vote for them. So since people voted for them, they are the better choice, and they're comfortable with the idea of occupying positions of power. But, of course, politics at that level is about self-interest, self-preservation. And especially in a second term, a president is mindful of a number of things. Number one, he's mindful, number one, of time. He has 4 years to accomplish a whole bunch of things, including his self-interest. So he's mindful also that he's got to live after the four-year period is done. And he wants to live nicely. His time in office ought to pay. It ought to afford him a very lucrative salary and a very decent lifestyle for him and his family, his children. And so in these next 4 years, he has to put in place those things that would guarantee that kind of lifestyle that he and his family, he thinks, ought to enjoy. So that would be a huge issue. He and his wife are relatively young people, which means they have quite a bit more years to be in the workforce, to be available, to be productive. And money talks. This is a Democratic Party, just like the Republican Party. They're into money and power, or conversely, into power and money. So these next 4 years, well, these are the things that would be on the president's mind. In the next 4 years, what would also be on his mind would be posterity. How will he be regarded by history after he's gone? And that shapes a lot about the president's attitude and the president's actions. A president is likely not to be so brazen or bold, or not to be so reckless as to injure his historical profile. He will be careful and calculating, because once he leaves office, he will be the subject of a lot of study. But more than anything else, he would want to have a popular profile, a profile among the people of something very positive, just like Clinton. Clinton's popularity is extraordinary. It does not square with the reality of what Clinton really was as a president. It's like night and day. But it doesn't matter, because as long as that popularity is out there, it feeds into the ego need to be relevant and to be satisfied that the power was, you know, wide-ranging. People love me all over the place, not just in the United States. They love me all over the world. I'm great. And Martin Scorsese is making a movie about me. I'm now immortal. So that happens as well with a second-term president. Let's take a look at this president, Barack Obama. Barack Obama came through the Democratic Leadership Council, which is, people may be shocked to know, and maybe some would call me and say I'm wrong, but it is a conservative movement within the Democratic Party. Before he ran for office, he was thoroughly vetted by the Democratic Leadership Council to make sure that he fit the profile of the council. You don't become a member of the Democratic Leadership Council as a raging liberal, a raging progressive. You are a conservative Democrat. And some people would say, well, that does not exist, but it does exist. The Democratic Leadership Council, formed specifically to give the party another dimension. It's not quite, you know, it's not the racist Dixiecrats of old, and it's not the screaming liberals either. It's right in the middle. It's centrist or right-leaning, but certainly not left-leaning. This was a really incredible feat that Bill Clinton was able to carry off. He was able to present himself as a liberal, but he was absolutely not. And I'm afraid that Barack Obama is exactly of the same mold. Presenting himself as a liberal, but I'm not so sure, based on his actions, that he is. And I mean liberal in the best possible sense, okay? as an enlightened person, a person with a broad vision. But when you square the talk against the actions, you see there is a disconnect. We saw that in the first 4 years. So this Democratic Leadership Council has its own ideology. And I saw it with Bill Clinton, and I'm seeing exactly, it's almost like a script, following in exactly the same footsteps, doing the same things. The Bill Clinton that people know is a very likable, affable guy, a visionary. In fact, that's this whole point about the institute that he has founded, named after himself. But it is about the new way. In fact, Clinton refers to it as the third way, meaning not right, not left, but center, moderate, conservative. Clinton, of course, and this is the parallel, Clinton had introduced the idea of subsidized individual savings accounts for Social Security. Now, you may never think that, but he did. He was the president who sought to increase taxes on Social Security benefits for the elderly and disabled. You may never think that, but he did so in 1993. In 1999, Clinton proposed investing the Social Security Trust Fund in risky assets in the stock market and in bonds. You may never think that, but it happened in 1999. He also threw out of the window legislation that was supposed to basically tightly regulate the banking industry and Wall Street. Says those are not important. Clinton was a person who was very, very conservative, pro-death penalty, things like that. You would never think that when you look at Bill Clinton and he stands up and he sounds very reasonable and so forth, but this was a pro-death penalty. You remember that he took time out of office to make sure that a mentally disabled person was actually executed in Arkansas. So these things are not squaring, but they are the new type of Democrat, and they are moving the party in the direction to say that we have to relate to the new people out there who would tend to retreat from very, very liberal values and ideas and come back more to the center, come back to a semi-conservative point of view. And that is in anticipation of the demographic shift in the United States. While people are praising it because it's now a plurality, a plural society with all these different ethnic groups, and it's a melting pot and all the great anthropological things that should happen because of that. Politically, there is a sense that ground will be lost to the people, and you begin early to move in a direction where when people are afraid, they tend to be conservative. They tend not to be liberal. They tend not to be progressive. They tend not to be generous. They tend to be pretty narrow-minded. And that's where the Democratic Party is going. Barack Obama was a splendid and is still a splendid vehicle for the Democratic Party. He could not have succeeded absolutely could not have succeeded without paying deference to this Democratic Leadership Council and to the ideological turn that it wishes to take. And his actions are proving that he is very much in step with that. This president has never really discussed poverty, which is alarming. You've had 4 years to tell us about what you understand the poor people of this country to be, what they should, why they should have a trusted look at you as really, truly a sign of hope. President Obama does not talk about poverty. He never uses the word poor. The lowest he's willing to go. He doesn't even talk about the working class. He doesn't, he cuts off at middle class. So it's middle class and above. Anything below middle class, well, you know, he'll have to sit down and really study an answer of response to those people. But in a sense, that grouping, which is a very large grouping, are to Barack Obama what the 47% was to Mitt Romney. They're write-offs. We haven't seen this administration really doing the job of getting this society back together as a whole society, despite all the prating about the red states. We don't want the red states and blue states. We are the United States. Well, we don't see that happening in this administration. We didn't see it in the last 4 years. And there's a hesitancy to be critical, openly critical of Barack Obama because, well, you know, the guy is a first. Okay? And he's a young guy trying to do the right thing. He's smart, and what he needs is support from the people. And he needs understanding, and he needs, you know, benefit of the doubt, and he needs room and space, and he needs, you know, a margin of error. He needs all these things. And I say, great, he got it. He is in office, which is an expression of all of the above. He didn't get there by himself. Obviously, people had to choose to put him there. And they chose to do that 4 years ago. But you can't tell me that in your 4 years in office, you could talk to everybody but the folks who really put you in office. You can basically have daily conversations with others. And you make yourself available to the corporate sector. And you take the taxpayers' money and you bail them out. You bail out Wall Street, but you can't bail out the people defaulting on their mortgages. Give them a break. You can address yourself to all kinds of injustices all over the world. But you can't address yourself to the injustices here. Leading the world in the number of people in prison. And let me be clear, I'm glad that there's some place to put really, really bad people. But I've covered enough cases to know that not everybody in prison is there because they're guilty. It is still a racially bifurcated judicial system. But our president is not mindful and is not dealing with these things. Our president has not yet tackled an overhauling of anything. I mean overhaul. I mean a thorough clean out from top to bottom assessment of what's working and what's not working, what ought to be thrown out and replaced, and what agencies simply need to cease existing. What has to happen to get things done? We haven't seen that kind of a Marshall Plan coming from this president, from the very people hoping that he understands how crucial it is for him to get to that agenda. But of course, people backed away. They backed away and they said, well, we got to give the brother some room. Well, the brother has had enough room, way too much room. And in this second term, my suggestion is that the people become, my two favorite words, ruthless and obsessive about our interests, and give him no more room, no more room. We have to be animated and we have to be clear. We are entitled to have our very pressing needs met, because after all, they're not extraordinary needs in the sense that we're asking for outlandish things. We're asking for a just way of operating in all these different spheres. In banking, we want a just banking system. You can't tell me that what's going on with Bank of America and Morgan Stanley and Chase and all these other banks, and they're penalizing people. You have the Bank of America getting billions of dollars, doing really well right now, doing so well they're about to lay off another 30 to 60,000 employees. And this is our president. And he says nothing. We have to have a resolution among ourselves as people who have made some kind of investment. And even if you didn't make an investment, the fact is somebody has. And this office of president ought to be sending very different signals right now. And it is troubling that they are slow in coming, and in some cases, they're not coming at all. So all bets are off for Obama point one. Obama got the slide. Obama point zero got a slide. Obama point one should have no room, no more benefit of the doubt. It's done. The consequences are serious. So, with that in mind, we have to figure how we are going to use what are the systems that we have available to us. We talked about third parties, and I have some issues with the third parties. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be supported. But this is the time for them to get really serious about organizing. We need unions to come to their senses. Don't get all mad when Michigan goes right to work. And they're the 24th state, and you were asleep at the wheel for the previous 23, and then you suddenly get mad at the 24th one to slip out of your grasp. This is a time to assess where you have gone wrong, how you have created a distance between yourselves as a leadership and your membership. This is a time for people to pool their interests together, to be smart to form coalitions. They need not be permanent coalitions, but they can be working associations insofar as joining with each other advances the cause or the interests of the conjoined groups. We don't have to be permanently married to each other. But we have to see that kind of activity going on now. We have to look at the future leadership within our communities and look to leaders that are groomable, are leadership material. We also have to organize against leadership that we have in our communities that is not doing a good job. Organize. And wherever we are, in whatever spheres of influence we happen to function in, we have to rev up the volume a bit and take a little bit more responsibility for something. It doesn't matter what it is. But be actively involved in something. And use that as the basis of a whole new response as a civilian, a person who is engaged at the community level. That's what we are lacking. We are lacking people who are organic leaders and members of communities. So this 113th Congress, the first Congress after the 2010 redistricting by virtue of the census, this new Congress that boasts one of the most integrated members of Congress ever on the books, all these wonderful things that are supposed to be pluses. The people have to remind themselves that those 535 people, first and foremost, for the most part, are about self. It's okay if they are about self, but we should have evolved by now to the point where we can serve dotus on those people who are self-absorbed and not doing the work or the will of the people, that they are on borrowed time. And we ought to be very aggressive in this next Congress, very, very aggressive in responding, not in the aftermath of things, but before things happen, because we know what's going to happen. Like I said, I know that Barack Obama would do exactly as Bill Clinton did and make some very deep cuts that would hurt a lot of people. And he will profess publicly the exact opposite, as he did, that's part of the speech after the fiscal cliff agreement. And he said he had changed the tax code. No, he hasn't. He hasn't changed the tax code. You tweak a little thing here and you tweak a little thing there. We haven't changed the tax code. To change the tax code means you throw out the whole thing and you start all over again. And you introduce something brand new and innovative. That is not happening. Not with this president. He's a tweaker. He's a tweaker. He's not coming in there to make grand changes. That is not going to happen. He'll be tweaking, and the tweaking will have very serious consequences for the people he doesn't talk about. The P people, the poor people, the people who are living in poverty, the working poor, the working class. That's what he's talking about. Okay, I'll take a break and come back to your thoughts at 888-874-4888 and hear what you have to say. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead on PRN.FM. It's your turn to talk at 888-874-4888. And thank you, San Francisco, for joining us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Eutrice. Hope you're having a good New Year.
It's Eutrice.
Oh, Eutrice. I'm sorry.
Yes, that's all right.
You know, it's funny you were mentioning Obama and the Democratic Leadership Conference. I remember before the 2008 election, there was a speech on C-SPAN with Obama at the DLC, and he was enormously proud of being a member of it. And people aren't familiar with the DLC, Democratic Leadership Conference. They included John Tower, Sam Nunn. I'm trying to think of some of the really heavy-handed military-industrial complex types.
Those are the guys who started it. Sam Nunn was one of the founders of it.
Right, yeah. So they were very, I mean, they make Nixon and, you know, Reagan look like patty cakes. I mean, people were almost cheering when John Tower died because he was seen as not only so corrupt that, I mean, there were military types. A lot of people don't remember. When Reagan was in office, there was what was called the Iran-Iraq War. And it was Reagan had bought so many weapons programs that were useless, really useless weapons, very expensive, top secret weapons that America bought that were so useless that nobody wanted to buy them. They would be taken to the arms shows all around the world, and nobody wanted to buy them. So they came up with the Iran-Iraq War just to be able to play these various weapons programs against each other as a product test ground. And so the issue of Saddam Hussein versus the Ayatollah was not really a war. It was more of a product test ground because we had sold those weapons to the Shah. We had sold them to Turkey and Syria and Israel and Iran and Iraq. And as a matter of fact, Oliver North was delivering these same weapon systems back and forth secretly to all of these different countries. And that was a big part of what the Iran-Contra scandal was all about.
Let's talk about the 113th Congress, though.
Sure, sure. Well, specifically, I looking at this issue of the fiscal cliff, one of the most corrupt banks that we know of, UBS, was busted about 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and they've agreed to pay $1.5 billion as a settlement for their part in the LIBOR scandal.
And right, we talked about that here. We did, about the UBS being the latest member to join the billion-dollar fine club.
Right, right. And actually, their $1.5 billion is only for one count. The emails show between 800 and 2,000 counts of fraud. So potentially, we could take them for everything they've got. But this UBS is a very corrupt bank. It's thought that Adolf Hitler's personal Swiss bank account was with UBS, that they did much of the money laundering of hiding the Nazi gold and the Nazi artwork and whatnot. And so the idea that Bloomberg Network is now calling for yanking UBS's corporate charter. And this is very profound because if we were to yank their corporate charter, their assets in America would revert to the U.S. Treasury. They would be seen as an organized crime bank that everything they own in America would revert to the U.S. Treasury. And that's one of the options that we've got.
Well, I talked about that before. In fact, when the Justice Department filed its first lawsuit, I said, you know, it's amazing that they are anticipating a settlement as opposed to a prosecution and the eventual revocation of the charters of these banks. But we're slightly off topic. I wanted to find out. Let me ask you directly then. Mm-hmm. What is your feeling now, okay, as we enter the second term of Barack Obama and this Congress? Do you feel yourself out of the loop, in the loop? Do you feel yourself anticipating that you would have some trouble with some of the legislation that is about to happen?
Well, if you were to ask me that, as an individual, I don't, but it's only because I personally, just maybe it's my personality style, I make a point to stay in the loop on every one of these issues. When I call up these radio talk shows, I kind of steer the arguments. If the neocons are trying to spin the story in one way, I make sure that the story gets spun my way. And as a matter of fact, as that goes, the future, as I look at it, has to do with regaining our, if civilization is strengthened by a democracy, and a democracy is strengthened by education, then it's important for us to refocus on making sure that education is refinanced, that we cherish education, that we don't put gun-toting guards at every door of the schools, but that instead we develop an education that actually gives kids a future, so that they don't feel so desperate that they've got to go shoot up the place, and that their parents believe that there's a future. That's really what it's all about. And so to me, education is the key to all of this. And a part of that comes into, for example, with UBS. If what they did with the LIBOR was to slander the entire world, basically, what they did with the LIBOR is to set interest rates higher and higher and higher on everybody, on every nation, on every aspect of life. They demanded that everyone's reputation be kowtowed to their numbers. Their numbers were fraudulent, so everyone's reputation was fraudulent. So we have to regain our reputations, whether it's through education, whether it's through Jubilee, whether it's through asset forfeiture, whether it's by electing honest politicians, but it all has to do with regaining our reputation so that we can move together in a future.
Thank you very much, David, for your contribution today. Thanks a lot. 888-874-4888. What are you prepared to do as the 113th Congress is about to begin its business? How are you situating yourself mentally and otherwise in terms of activism with respect to this 113th Congress or this president's second term? That's the question. That's the question. And it's a challenge. Well, we're getting close to our time. And I wanted to say also, please feel free to continue. I keep getting really great emails, and it's also about suggestions for shows. Thank you very much for your ideas at leadstories@gmail.com. I really appreciate your comments and your thoughtful ideas. And I also, I'm thankful for your praise. I really am thankful. It's a really nice thing to open up your emails and to see the kind words that you share with me. Thank you so much for that. I also want to tell you that starting next week, I'll kind of outline some programs and projects that I think I'd like us at Lead Stories to continue to be involved in. And these are things that we can do to make a difference to a whole group of people. So we'll do that starting next week. So stay tuned. Mike Fader is up next with Occupied Territory. We'll see each other tomorrow. God willing, the creek don't rise. Bye-bye.